the only memorial in Ciudad Juarez dedicated to those who died in the most violent years of the so-called drug war. Father Manriquez explained the purpose behind the modest mural.
The park is very nice. It's serving its purpose, and that's great. But what about those who have lost someone and are sad? Don't they have a place in the park as well? Are we supposed to celebrate and say, we now have a park and everything is beautiful, and pretend like we don't care about those who died? No, we do care. That's why we created the memorial. It's first and foremost an embrace of solidarity for those who have lost their loved ones. But it's also a lesson to remind us how far things went due to our lack of civic responsibility, so that it doesn't happen again.
The memorial only has space for about 800 nameplates, each one paid for by loved ones of the victims. While it's not large enough to name the more than 10,000 lives lost in Ciudad Juarez, it is a tangible recognition of the collective trauma and a lesson about the recent past. Shannon Young, FSRN, Ciudad Juarez.
Stay tuned tomorrow when Shannon Young continues her report from Ciudad Juarez, where residents are using art to recover from the trauma of violence. That's tomorrow on FSRN and at FSRN.org. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Shauna Ray and Carla West. FSRN's last daily news program will be this Friday, September 27th. Find out more about what's next for FSRN on our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
It's odd that they, the enemy, believe that we're stronger than we know or think we are, right? The other part of the equation is that they believe that people who watch it on TV or watch it in the movie theater, read this book, will do nothing. So it's safe. It's safe to put this out to the American people. They're so sure of that because they know that they have dumbed down and numbed out the minds of the American public to such an extent that once TV Nation or The Awful Truth or Roger Me is over, people can just turn the dial, go to Everybody Loves Raymond, and not think about it anymore. Now, I've always believed something different. I believe that this will actually grow to be something very large because the American people are, at their core, good. And they have good hearts, and they have good souls, and they have a conscience.
Tune in this October for the Voices of WBAI, a membership drive with a difference. Pacifica Radio, a unique voice in New York City for more than 50 years. 99.5 FM and online at WBAI.org.
Hello, this is your old friend Radio's Uncle Sidney. Well, it's fundraising time again, and like you, I can't help but notice how badly these things are crapping out. Geez, we've tried everything on you, Rubes. Magic beans, tinfoil mine reading hats, even them special glasses that lets you see folks naked. Hell, we even told the truth a few times. No dice. I thought we was doomed. However, there's a solution. Yes, a solution. And it was right under our noses the whole time. Yes, moms and dads, girls and boys. Yes, from now on, as supplies last, with every subscription to our beloved WBAI, that's WBAI.org, with every sub, we'll send you, yes, you, a liberally weighted nickel bag of genuine medical marijuana. Oh, yes, we've come into possession of a rather vast amount of this green and natural miracle weed, which, by the way, has been thoroughly tested by our staff. So if you want to support Radio WBAI and have your mind thoroughly blown, then call today and join the WBAI family. You'll be glad you did. This offer void where prohibited by law. The proceeding was a work of satire. Please don't arrest us.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Streaming live at WBAI.org. The new BAI theme song, Survival, or I Will Survive, or whatever it's called, from the latest release from Muse, coming up in a moment. Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Possibly right after this, if it plays. Hey,
hey. Perhaps it's true that things can change in a day. That a few dozen hours can affect the outcome of whole lifetimes. And that when they do, those few dozen hours, like the salvaged remains of a burned house, the charred clock, the singed photograph, the scorched furniture, must be resurrected from the ruins and examined, preserved, accounted for. Little events, ordinary things, smashed and reconstituted, imbued with new meaning. Suddenly they become the bleached bones of a story. Long before the Marxists came, before the British took Malabar, before Vasco da Gama arrived, long before Christianity arrived in a boat, that it really began in the days when the love laws were made.
Tune in this October for the voices of WBAI, a membership drive with a difference. Pacifica Radio, a unique voice in New York City for more than 50 years. 99.5 FM and online at WBAI.org.
My medical oregano?
You don't have to sign up for medical oregano.
I don't need a medical oregano card.
The medicinal properties of oregano are well known.
I know. I heard it on WBAI.
Even so, my brother was unable to speak, could not walk. We gave him oregano.
And it cured him?
First he started to crawl.
Oh.
Then he sort of toddled.
Could he say anything?
He said da-da.
Oh.
Then mama. And then he went off to kindergarten.
And you owe it all to oregano.
No, we owe it all to WBAI.
Well, what about the oregano?
We put it on his pizza.
If you owe it all to WBAI, make sure to keep your membership current. For only $25 a year, you will enjoy all the privileges of membership, including the right to vote in WBAI's democratically run elections. And don't forget to sprinkle some oregano on your pizza.
Hey, this oregano is cut with pot. Who was that guy? This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM. I'm Robert Knight, and I hereby welcome you to Earthwatch. And in today's program, we shall take a critical look at the lies of spies and the abominations of the Obamas and the espionage that was ordered to be taken place at the United Nations by your next president, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State. cackling at the sodomy and murder of Muammar Gaddafi. Your next president, dear liberal. We shall cover lies told at the General Assembly by your first Negro president, Barack Obama. My God, whoever would have imagined that negritude would be an inoculation against justice? Well, the theme of today's edition of Earthwatch is espionage, NSA, surveillance, and its consequences both internationally, domestically, and psychologically. And hopefully, one of these days, when you get over these fascist Democrats, politically. I'm Robert Knight, here now, Earthwatch, on WBAI Pacifica.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Beating sound of the hammer for justice that comes. When the will the world stop and listen, when will we all stop and see? He looks upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. Still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Long as there's life, there's still a day. Long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at stream.wbai.org. My name is Robert Knight, and in today's program, we're going to take a look at the shadow, the underbelly of espionage and surveillance, and how it took an Obama to enact the worst of the Cheney. The runaway high technology espionage on you and me and everybody in the world. The NSA, just the iceberg of the tip of the volcanic mountain of privacy violations that are defended so glibly by Barack Obama this Monday at the United Nations, after being reamed by the President of Brazil, after being rejected by important nations of this world. The collaboration between state and corporate security and marketing is astonishing. You think that you have an Android or an iPhone. It's really an ankle bracelet. Every breath you take, every move you make, every place you go, they will know. What's so silly about peace, love, and dumb phones? You know, I used to work in direct marketing. Wrote big money fundraising letters. Did that for WBAI also, you know. I've raised more than $1 million for this station. Such as circumstances may currently be. And there, in those days, every triviatum and cross-reference was useful and nuances, and we have gone so exponentially beyond what we used to do on mainframes, you know, with big data. Now data is so big, they have to build a new NSA volcanic structure in Utah and a band played on. Oh, wait, I gotta update my Facebook. Oh, dig this tweet. You run naked through this world. You know nothing of what they know about you. They know what you're gonna do next. They track. Whether it's through those state toll pass IDs with the barcodes, the monitoring of license plates with those photographic reflectors on the back of police cars, whether it's the data valence of millions of security cameras, whether it's the tap on your phone, the knock on your door, the cloud of your data that you share with corporations. Diplomat or doofus, we're all caught in the dragnet. And I was brought to rage to hear your president, Barack Obama, at the United Nations on Monday saying, We'll seek the balance between security against terrorism and legitimate but unimportant concerns about privacy. Hi, yeah, 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 yeah. So he sets up a panel to investigate the abuses. Abuse. You know, there are contexts of that word in which abuse is not an unpleasant term. Abuse is too kind a word for the untimely ripping of your privacy and dignity from your reasonable expectation of privacy. And this corporate front man, Barack Obama, and his health lying wife.
Well, you know, if you drink water, you'll get a lot more energy.
And I feel like a voice in the wilderness, because you, my beloveds, you're going to be foolish. I just know you are. And you're going to elect the even more wicked one, Hillary Clinton. I know you're going to do that. You've got 2 years to come to your senses. I think the Democrats should change their name to the Judas Goat Party. Republicans are crazy, but Democrats are insidious. You don't believe me? Look at the mind lock that is put on corporate media with BSNBC and CNN again. And look at the Amen Corner. And bless your lucky stars, there is a Pacifica Radio. This is Earthwatch. My name is Robert Knight. And as I said, our theme today is busting the spies, the espionage that's taking place on every electronic transaction you make. I do not use a so-called smartphone. It's an antonym. Because if you use one, you ain't that smart. Because they're tracking everything you do. During the time that we were producing, and will once again produce, the investigative news program called 5 O'Clock Shadow, a good part of our presentation was about the revelations of WikiLeaks, Glenn Greenwald, Snowden, and original presentations of State Department cables and the transposition of it to an audio-friendly format. And always a skeptical consciousness about how it's always about the content of character, not color of skin. You all elected Obama a second time because you're afraid to, you know.
Well, he is our first black president. We wouldn't want him to be our first black president elected only once.
Or whatever the hell it was.
Well, the Republicans are worse.
Can you think of a world worse than Obama's attempt to create yet another war in Syria? So why are we celebrating a black president when he's a fascist president? Why are we celebrating a Negro on the Supreme Court when he's Clarence Thomas? As Martin said, content of character over color of skin. Content of character over gender. There was a Republican Latino fool, you know, who did a grandstand play in Congress today. You gonna vote for him because he's a Latino? You gonna vote for Hillary because she's a woman? If this life means nothing, it is about the transcendence of the soul. and the purity of the spirit, and the inclusiveness of justice beyond an emblem that is bought and sold and traded so many times over you do not even recognize it anymore. Obama's black, Hillary's a woman. So the bleep what? Content of character, color of skin. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this week is the beginning of the September season of the United Nations General Assembly. And in tonight's program, we'll hear both a domestic and an international analysis from excerpts from the recent Democracy in Crisis Conference, as well as, and here, we let her speak for herself. A woman who is a president and a leader of principle in her message to the world. We next hear, in regard to the Obama administration's NSA espionage scandal, and remember, I remind you once again, it was Hillary Clinton who sent a memo, as we know from the WikiLeaks cables, to all State Department personnel saying, get fingerprints, pick up glasses, get spittle samples, get DNA. Why would that woman want DNA samples of diplomats? Why would she want her employees checking the bed sheets of the Ambassador Hotel? Why is Obama defending the violation of the Constitution that he once pretended to teach about? Well, revelations of Edward Snowden in regard to Brazil when he was when he revealed that Brazil was a special target of Barack Obama's administration in terms of espionage. And on Monday, the chickens came home to roost at the UN General Assembly in the following address by the President of Brazil.
Mr. President, I wish to bring to the attention of attending delegations an issue which I view as being utterly important and serious. Recently disclosed information on the activities carried out by a global network of electronic spying has brought about anger and repudiation in vast sectors of public opinion worldwide. In Brazil, the situation was even more serious, since we Brazil feature as a target of such an intrusion. Citizens' personal data and information have been indiscriminately targeted and intercepted. Business information, oftentimes of high economic and even strategic value, have been the target of spying activity. Also, communications by Brazilian diplomatic representation offices, including the permanent mission of Brazil with the United Nations and even the very presidency of Republic of Brazil, were subject to interception of communications. Meddling in such a manner in the life and affairs of other countries is a breach of international law, and as such, it is an affrontment to the principles that should otherwise govern relations among countries, especially among friendly nations. A country's sovereignty can never affirm itself to the detriment of another country's sovereignty. The right to security of a country's citizens can never be ensured by violating the fundamental human and civil rights of another country's citizens. Even worse, when private sector companies uphold this type of spying activity. The argument that illegal interception of information and data is allegedly intended to protect nations against terrorism is untenable. Mr. President, Brazil knows how to protect itself. Brazil, Mr. President, repudiates. Brazil tackles and does not provide shelter to terrorist groups. We are a democratic country, surrounded by democratic, peaceful countries that respect international law. We have been living in peace with our neighbors for more than 140 years. Like so many other Latin Americans, I myself fought on a first-hand basis against arbitrary behavior and censorship, and I could therefore not possibly fail to uncompromisingly defend individuals' rights to privacy and my country's sovereignty. Without the right to privacy, there is no real freedom of speech or freedom of opinion, and therefore there is no actual democracy. Without respect to sovereignty, there is no base for proper relations among nations. What we have before us, Mr. President, is a serious case of violation of human rights and civil liberties. A case of invasion and capture of confidential secret information pertaining to business activities. And above all, a case of disrespect to national sovereignty, the national sovereignty of my country. We have let the U.S. government know about our protest by demanding explanations, apologies, and guarantees that such acts or procedures will never be repeated again. Friendly governments and societies that seek to consolidate a truly strategic partnership, such as is our case, cannot possibly allow recurring and illegal actions to go on as if they were normal, ordinary practice. Such actions are totally unacceptable. Mr. President, Brazil will further double its efforts to equip itself with legislation, technologies, and the mechanisms that will protect us properly against illegal interception of communications and data. My administration will do everything within its reach and powers to defend the human rights of all Brazilians and to protect the human rights of all citizens in the world while protecting the fruits of the ingenious efforts of Brazilian workers and corporations. The problem, however, goes beyond the bilateral relations of two countries. It affects the international community itself and as such requires an answer from it. Information and communications or telecommunications technologies cannot become a new battlefield among states. The time has come for us to foster the conditions required to prevent that the cyberspace becomes or be instrumentally manipulated as a weapon of war by means of spying activities, sabotage, and attacks against the systems and infrastructures owned by third-party countries. The United Nations organization should perform a leadership role in an effort to properly regulate the behavior of states regarding these technologies, and also consider the importance of the internet and social networks as part of our efforts to build democracy worldwide. For that reason, Mr. President, Brazil will put forth proposals aimed at establishing a multilateral civil framework for internet governance and use, as well as measures to ensure effective protection of the data and information trafficking through the internet. We must establish multilateral mechanisms for the World Wide Web, mechanisms that are capable of ensuring materialization of principles such as, for example, number one, freedom of speech, individuals' privacy, and respect to human rights. Principle number two, democratic governance, multilateral, democratic, and open governance. Exercise with a sense of transparency while encouraging collective creation and a broad-ranging participation of society, governments, and the private sector. The third is the principle of universality that ensures social and human development as well as the construction of inclusive, non-discriminatory societies. The fourth is the principle of cultural diversity without any imposition of beliefs, customs, or values. Principle number five, that of network neutrality, by observing only technical and ethical criteria, thus making unacceptable any restriction due to political, commercial, religious reasons, or any other reason. Full utilization of the internet's potential therefore involves responsible regulation that will, at the same time, guarantee freedom of speech, security, and respect to human rights. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, the choice of the post-2015 development agenda as the theme of this session of the General Assembly could not be more timely. The fight against poverty, hunger, and inequality constitutes the biggest challenge of our times. For that reason, in Brazil, we have put in place an economic model coupled with social inclusion, one that is ultimately anchored on the creation of jobs and strengthening of family farming, expansion of credit availability, appreciation in the value of workers' wages, and the construction of a broad-ranging social protection network, particularly by means of our family stipend program. In addition to the above-mentioned accomplishments and gains, we have uplifted from extreme poverty 22 million Brazilians through the Brazil Free of Extreme Poverty Plan within no more than 2 years. We have drastically reduced child mortality in Brazil. A recent UNICEF report highlights Brazil as a country that has fostered one of the major drops in the child mortality indicator in the whole world. Children are a top priority for Brazil. This is translated in our commitment to education. We are the one country in the world that has most increased public investment in the educational sector, according to the latest OECD report. By means of law, we have now earmarked 75% of all oil revenues to education and 25% to the health sector. Mr. President, in the debate on the post-2015 development agenda, we should focus on the results attained at the Rio Plus 20 conference as key drivers. The major step we took in Rio de Janeiro consisted in placing poverty at the very center of the sustainable development agenda. Poverty, Mr. President, is not a problem that is peculiar only to developing countries. And environmental protection is not a goal to be pursued only when poverty has been overcome. The meaning and the purpose of the post-2015 agenda are about building a world in which it is possible to grow, to include, to conserve, and to protect. Mr. President, by promoting social mobility and by overcoming extreme poverty as we have been doing, we have established a huge contingent of citizens who now enjoy better standards of living and have greater access to information and a keener awareness of their rights. Citizens who are now endowed with new hopes, new wishes, and new demands. The June demonstrations in Brazil are an inseparable part of our process of building democracy and social change. My administration did not crack down on those street demonstrations. Much on the contrary, we listened to and understood the voices coming from the streets. We listened to and understood their voices because we ourselves came from the streets. We were educated day to day and became who we are as part of the great struggles of Brazil. The streets are our ground, our base. The demonstrators did not ask for a return to the past. Rather, demonstrators did ask for further progress towards a future of more rights, more participation, and even more social gains. In Brazil, it was in this decade that we saw the greatest reduction in inequality in the past 50 years. It was in this decade that we established a social protection system that has allowed us to now virtually overcome extreme poverty. We know all too well that democracy breeds more desire for more democracy. Social inclusion breeds demands for even more social inclusion. Quality of life awakens people's yearning for even more quality of life. In our view, all of the progress made so far is always just a beginning. Our development strategy requires more, very much in line with the yearnings and wishes of all Brazilians. For that reason, it is not enough to hear or listen to them. It is necessary to do more, to change this extraordinary energy into achievements to the benefit of all. For that reason, I have recently launched 5 major pacts: the Pact Against Corruption and for Political Reform, the Pact for Urban Mobility aimed at improving public transportation and at fostering an urban reform, a Pact for Education, our great passport to the future, with support from the Oil Resources Revenues and the Oil Social Fund, the Pact for Health, which provides for doctors to assist and save the lives of Brazilians who live in the most remote and poorest corners of the country, the Pact for fiscal responsibility in order to ensure feasibility of this new stage in our history. Ladies and gentlemen, although the most acute phase of the crisis is now behind us, the fact remains that the world economic situation remains fragile, with unacceptable unemployment levels. ILO statistics point out that there are more than 200 million unemployed people worldwide. The phenomenon affects the population of both developed and developing countries. This is the right time for us to strengthen the trends for growth in the world's economy, trends that are pointing towards signs of recovery. Emerging countries alone cannot ensure a resumption of global growth. More than ever before, it is necessary to engage in concerted action in order to reduce unemployment and reestablish momentum in international trade. We are all on the same boat. My country is restoring growth despite the impact of the international crisis in the past few years. We have relied on 3 key elements. Number 1, commitment towards sound macroeconomic policies. Number 2, continuing and upholding successful social inclusion policies. And number 3, adoption of measures aimed at increasing our productivity and therefore our international competitiveness. We are committed to stability, to inflation control, to improving the quality of public spending, and to upholding proper fiscal performance. We reiterate, Mr. President, our support to a reform of the IMF. Governance of the fund should reflect the weight of emerging and developing countries in the world's economy. Delaying this adaptive reform will further reduce the fund's legitimacy and effectiveness. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, the year 2015 will mark the 70th anniversary of the United Nations and the 10th anniversary of the World Summit of 2005. As such, it will be an occasion for us to carry out the urgent reform that we have been calling for since that first summit. We must avoid a collective defeat of coming to 2015 without a Security Council capable of fully exercising its responsibilities in today's world. The limited representation of the United Nations Security Council in view of the new challenges of the 21st century is a source of grave concern. Examples of that concern include the huge difficulty in offering a solution to the ongoing Syrian conflict and the state of paralysis in addressing the Israeli-Palestinian question. On important issues, the recurring polarization among permanent members has led to a dangerous inaction. The Council must be urgently endowed with voices that are both independent and constructive. Only by expanding the number of permanent and non-permanent members of the Security Council and by including developing countries in both categories will it be possible to solve and overcome the current representativeness and legitimacy deficit that the Council suffers from. Mr. President, the general debate provides us with an opportunity to reiterate the fundamental principles that guide my country's foreign policy and inform our stance on hot and pressing issues of today's international agenda. We guide ourselves and actions on a defense of a multilateral world, a world governed by international law, where peaceful solution of conflicts prevail, and also where the pursuit of a fair and solidarity-based order prevail both economically and socially. The crisis in Syria has caused commotion and breeds a sense of anger. 2.5 years of lost lives and destruction have caused the biggest humanitarian disaster of the century. Brazil, whose population of Syrian descent is an important component of our national identity, is deeply involved with this plight. It is necessary to prevent the killing of innocent people, women, children, and the elderly. It is necessary to silence weapons, whether conventional or chemical, whether used by the government or by the rebels. There is no military way out. The only solution is through negotiation, dialogue, and understanding. Syria's decision to accede to the Convention on the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and enforce it immediately was an important development. The measure, as such, is decisive to overcome the conflict and helps build a world free of chemical weapons. The use of such weapons, I stress, is heinous and unacceptable under any circumstances. We therefore support the agreement reached between the United States and Russia to eliminate Syria's chemical weapons. It is incumbent upon the Syrian government to fulfill it in its entirety and do so in good faith and in a spirit of cooperation. Under any circumstances and in any case, we repudiate unilateral interventions in contempt of international law and without authorization by the Security Council. That would only further worsen the lack of political stability in the region and would further increase human suffering. Likewise, a lasting peace between Israel and Palestine has taken on a new and pressing dimension given the sweeping changes that the Middle East is currently going through. The time has come for one to meet the legitimate Palestinian aspirations to an independent and sovereign state. The time has also come for us to materialize the ample international consensus for a two-state solution. Current talks between Israelis and Palestinians should yield practical and significant results towards an agreement. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, the history of the 20th century shows that giving up the multilateral system is a prelude to wars, with the ensuing trail of human destitution and devastation. The history of the 20th century also shows that promoting the multilateral system yields fruits on the ethical, political, and institutional fronts. May I thus renew an appeal for an ample and vigorous convergence of political will that will uphold and reinvigorate the multilateral system, of which the United Nations is the main pillar. When the United Nations organization was founded, the peoples of the world rallied around the hope that humankind would be able to overcome the wounds of World War II, the hope that, yes, it would be possible to rebuild from debris of destruction and massacre a new world of liberty, solidarity, and prosperity. We all have the responsibility not to let die such a generous hope, such a generous and fruitful hope. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. Robert Knight in New York, and we just heard the address to the United Nations General Assembly by the President of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, taking on the espionage state, the transnational espionage, so much expanded under the administration of Barack Obama, well beyond the dreams of John Poindexter and total information awareness. That same issue was taken up recently in a conference in Chicago called Democracy in Crisis. And among the speakers was New York's own and our frequent guest on 5 o'clock Shadow, Heidi Bogosian, the head of the National Lawyers Guild, laying it out chapter and verse about what is wrong with what Obama is doing in the trampling of the U.S. Constitution and violation of your privacy and mine.
Ida Boghossian is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, a progressive bar association.
It's a pleasure to be in Chicago. In 1971, when the FBI formally ended its counterintelligence programs, J. Edgar Hoover kept open the possibility of continuing them, calling the programs a success. Revelations of covert spying, made then as now by concerned citizens, resulted in the Church Committee investigating government intelligence activities and instituting what were significant reforms to curb spying and surveillance on Americans. Limits were placed on FBI spying. FISA courts were established to prevent a recurrence of Nixon's warrantless wiretapping, which had actually dated back to the 1920s when the government first developed audio technology that enabled it to spy on Americans. Even then, during the Church Committee hearings, Idaho Democrat Frank Church, chairman of the committee, found that every presidential administration, whether it be Republican or Democratic, had abused their power. He warned, quote, "The NSA's capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy at all. If a dictator ever took over," he said, "the NSA would enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back." Nearly four decades later, we don't have a tyrant in power, we don't have a dictator, but a confluence of factors have really threatened our privacy and constitutional protections. They include massive U.S. national defense spending, a powerful and virtually unchecked executive branch, a codependent corporate government intelligence state, sustained by a perpetual war on terror. Any campaign of perpetual war, as James Madison cautioned, makes it impossible for any nation to preserve its fundamental freedoms. So how did we arrive at this state? After the Cold War, the military establishment underwent a steady decrease in spending, reaching in the 1990s its nadir. The events of 9/11 permitted the U.S. to recoalesce and reinvigorate military spending. This merging of sophisticated technology, much of it designed specifically for data aggregation and surveillance, and billions of dollars for military spending in the name of securing our national security, animated the current surveillance state. The blurring of lines between what many understand to be traditional government functions with the attendant oversight and accountability that we rely on is due to an increasing sharing of information and duties between government and the private sector. The past half a century has witnessed an expansion of the executive branch of government, really dwarfing the legislative and judiciary branches. With what some call a unitary executive, we've come to see unparalleled secrecy, with punishment for members of the media whose investigative reporting sheds light on illegal or ineffective government and corporate policies. Under this shroud of secrecy, the close partnership between business and government has flourished, at times rendering the distinction between them virtually nil. On the few occasions when programs of wide-ranging surveillance gathering on ordinary Americans have been made public, there has been public outrage and some congressional action. For example, in 2002, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, conceived the Total Information Awareness Program. It created massive computer databases to collect information on everyone in the United States, from our emails to medical records to social networks, to analyze suspicious activities and connections between other individuals. For public relations reasons, the program's name was later changed to Terrorism Information Awareness to emphasize that it wasn't created to keep dossiers on all of us. A year later, after public outcry, Total Information Awareness was defunded by Congress. But despite its defunding, the basic structure of the program survived and was transferred to other intelligence agencies. However, perhaps one of the most important lessons learned that informs the current state of affairs, don't tell Congress if you want to keep something secret. The revolving door between government, intelligence officials, and the corporate defense industry ensures that both partners in this mass surveillance benefit, while we, the public at large, lose our privacy and our constitutional protections. 80% of the 108 three- and four-star generals and admirals who retired between 2004 and 2008 took jobs with defense contractors or consultants. In some cases, they continued to advise the Department of Defense, raising serious questions of potential bias and conflict of interest in how this work is carried out. In 2011, the Department of Defense paid nearly $100 billion to the five largest defense contractors, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman, and took at least nine of the top-level generals and admirals who recently retired took positions with those companies. So it's not surprising that the defense industry actively seeks out lobbyists with backgrounds in appropriations and with strong connections to the Hill. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington issued a report in late 2012 documenting in detail this revolving door between the Pentagon and private security. In becoming beholden to corporations to conduct our national security and intelligence, we forfeit the hallmarks of good government, namely oversight, quality control, transparency, and ultimately our own national security. A few other indicators of how virtual government and business have become in performing government functions include the fact that 70% of our intelligence is conducted by private sector contractors. Nearly 2,000 private security firms and 1,200 government organizations, according to a well-known Washington Post investigation, were engaged in the business of surveillance and counterterrorism. Facebook's former security chief, Max Kelly, left Facebook in 2010 for a job at NSA in 2010. And according to the New York Times, federal government intelligence agencies recruit technology experts, invest in Silicon Valley startups, and award classified contracts to avail themselves of the latest software technology to handle large quantities of data. Many of you know that Amazon was awarded $600 million in a CIA computer cloud contract, and that Amazon's CEO just purchased the Washington Post. With no end in sight for a perpetual war, the White House shows little sign of curbing this massive surveillance machinery. The quest for global information on an unparalleled level is designed to secure U.S. domination through total information control. At the same time, all human communications are being collected with the capacity to store them indefinitely being developed by these large private corporations. For Americans who say that if they have nothing to hide, there's no reason to object to pervasive surveillance, they would do well to reread the Bill of Rights and to recall how unbridled power in the hands of an elite few, be it the king or the president, may be used to oppress the people. Now that information can be stored, it can be accessed in the future to look for retroactive infractions. And of grave concern is the fact that our personal information, when stored, may be tampered with to change any number of details about our life history, from health records to employment or academic history, criminal records, financial transactions. Right now, there's no way to correct inaccurate data amassed on us by data aggregators and the government agencies. Several government agencies admit they contain vast amounts of inaccurate data on all of us. And anyone who says they have nothing to hide needs to look back over his or her life and think of an incident you've kept private. While for many, social media has transformed traditional notions of privacy, Many more are probably not aware of the repercussions of having nothing we do, of having everything we do, rather, under the watchful eye of government and corporations. Have you ever done something you're now embarrassed about or that you don't want to share with your employer or neighbor? Do you want your boss to know you may see a psychiatrist, are being treated for a medical condition, attend AA meetings, have paid someone under the table, or have a criminal arrest in your background? It's a fact that with untold number of federal and local laws on the books in this country, many of them woefully outdated, if this government wants to target you, it can find something you have done to say you've broken the law, especially now with use of the internet. Judge Alex Kozinski in California has claimed that the average citizen is, quote, probably a federal criminal. Thanks to the criminalization of certain types of otherwise non-threatening behavior, ranging from tax and regulatory infractions to violation of employee codes of conduct. Add violations of online user agreements, and probably everyone in this room has broken the law. Knowing this, anyone who claims to have nothing to hide should reconsider the implications of handing over to the authorities every detail of one's private life. But what should concern us now is that the current surveillance system is patently unconstitutional. Not only does warrantless collection of personal data violate the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but secret government interpretations of sections of the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendment are being used to justify a wholesale infringement of our rights. In a recently declassified document, FISA Judge John Bates wrote that the standards the government uses to search phone record databases for threats were, quote, so frequently and systematically violated that the program has never functioned effectively. We now have a window of opportunity in which to educate ourselves about the many ways we expose our personal information and to decide how we want to conduct our lives and hold our elected officials accountable. If we do not exercise our First Amendment rights to petition the government for a redress of grievances individually and collectively, we risk further imperiling them. In other words, if our government exceeds the authority granted to it under the Constitution, we the people have a right to formally complain and demand action. And according to our Constitution, the government must respond. Thank you.
Our next guest, Doc.
That was Heidi Bogosian speaking recently in Chicago at the Democracy in Crisis conference convened by Chicago Peace Action. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. My name is Robert Knight. And earlier in the program, we heard the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, speaking about the indignity of the Obama administration's expansion of the espionage of diplomatic and official offices of the Brazilian government. And before we continue with their insights on espionage and surveillance tonight, we noticed the following news item just in. One of the latest fruits of the ethical work of Edward Snowden, we might presume. This item just a short time ago from the Hindu newspaper, headlined, NSA planted bugs at Indian missions in D.C. and at the United Nations. Remember, we were speaking earlier about your next president, because you're going to vote for gender instead of content of character. Hillary Clinton, as we reported on 5 o'clock shadow, she sent out a memo to all United Nations personnel to gather fingerprints, napkins, lipstick, DNA on any and all diplomats at the United Nations. My friends, the plot thickens. Here now, this just in from the Hindu. Two of the most important nerve centers of Indian diplomacy outside the country, the permanent mission of India at the United Nations and the embassy in Washington, D.C., were targets of such sophisticated bugs implanted by the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, that entire computer hard disks might have been copied by the American agency. The UN Mission Building in New York and the embassy premises, including its annex in Washington, were on a top-secret list of countries and missions, many of them European allies of the United States, chosen for intensive spying. According to a top-secret NSA document obtained by the Hindu, the NSA selected India's UN office and the embassy as, quote, location target, quote, for infiltrating their computers and telephones with high-technology bugs, which might have given them access to vast quantities of internet traffic, emails, telephone, and office conversations, and even official documents stored digitally. Since the NSA revelations began in June, U.S. President Barack Obama and other top American officials have all claimed that the surveillance activities were aimed exclusively at preventing terrorist attacks. But the targeted spying of Indian diplomatic buildings could have been done for political and commercial reasons, not the core responsibility of the NSA. According to the 2010 comment, that's communications intelligence document, about, quote, close access SIGADs, quote, the offices of Indian diplomats and high-ranking military officials stationed at these important posts were targets of four different kinds of electronic snooping devices. And those four are Lifesaver, which facilitates imaging of hard drives of computers. Highlands, which makes digital collection from implants. Whoa. Vagrant, which collects data of open computer screens. And Magnetic, which is a collection of digital signals. Now, Vagrant I get, because you've got a raster and a scan, so as the as the bit being painted moves left to right, down, left to right, down, left to right, down, or whatever pattern the particular screen uses, there's a surge, you know, when the voltage goes up and down, so you can retro calculate what bits are on and what intensity and so on. I get that. But I'm fascinated by the item called Highlands, which, quote, makes digital collection from implants. Oh, my dear God, is the age of Obama the dawn of cyborgs? I know he's one. This is Earthwatch. I'm Margaret Knight. And we just came across that item that will be breaking in the news tomorrow. The Obama administration's espionage on the Indian embassy and mission to the United Nations, as well as other so-called allies. And our theme tonight is the NSA and unbridled espionage and the trampling of privacy and destruction of the Constitution under these days of skin and gender affection in which voters care not about the content of character, but only about equipment and color. That's why, having elected Obama, your punishment will be to have him followed by Hillary Clinton. Well, that's the international side of NSA spying. Our companion theme, of course, is the domestic analysis that was recently presented in Chicago by Peace Action, the so-called Democracy in Crisis Conference. We just finished hearing Heidi Boghossian of the National Lawyers Guild. Up next, Robert Jensen and John Nichols were also at that conference, and they too had something important and dynamic to say, and we hear that now. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and you tuned to WBAI New York.
You look like the Big Brother in 1984. If that it's you makes it so much better. I think the confluence of points, though, talks about that they're very serious issues. You know, I think, like Bob Jensen, I would like to say we should step back here and think about, you know, what's the context for what's taking place here and why it's important. And I think when we look at the NSA surveillance scandal and the crisis we face right now with really the elimination of civil liberties that have been known traditionally in the United States in our history, it goes back to two of the great problems at the founding of the Republic that the founders and the framers in their best days were obsessed with when they dealt with the notion of tyranny, when they set up this country. And one of them goes back to the very beginning of the first democratic experiments in ancient Greece, in Athens. And the first one is the incompatibility of having a permanent war economy or an empire with trying to have the rule of law and a democracy and a republic. There's a great deal of tension between the two. And the people who started this country, the framers, and they had their flaws, but one thing they were well aware of was that earlier efforts at self-government in Athens and in Greece and in Rome had collapsed primarily because those countries were military empires that were constantly at war, and you could not sustain a free society, a self-governing society, while you're constantly fighting wars. And James Madison, and what I think might be the single greatest quote ever that you already quoted, so I'm going to quote it again because it's that good. Madison was obsessed with the threat of militarism to having a free society, for not only civil liberties, but for even the whole constitutional system to survive. And he said, of all the enemies of liberty, war is the most dreaded, because within war is the germ of every other threat to liberty. And what he meant by that, he went on to expound, was when you have a society that's permanently at war, you have corruption is unavoidable, inequality is unavoidable, secrecy is unavoidable, and propaganda. He used a different term, emoluments, but he meant propaganda to whip up the population to hysterically follow the militaristic path is unavoidable. And so Madison said, if you have a permanent war economy, you cannot have a free society or democracy. Those factors will all come into play. They always accompany militarism. As he said famously at the end of the passage, no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Boy, those are words every American should think really long and hard about, because we have now on 6 decades of being permanently at war. 6 decades of having a military infrastructure that is completely unaccountable, not just to the public, but to Congress. Or as Heidi said, even to the courts. There's just zero accountability for this military national security establishment. It has a life of its own. It's a $1 trillion plus industry when you put all the costs together, unaccountable to anyone. And we're trying to plant that alongside a free society and a democracy. Madison said that's impossible. History says that's impossible. And we're trying that experiment right now. And I don't like how it's turning out so far. I think we might want to rethink that one. And then one point about this that's really important, and you talked about this a little bit, Heidi, but it's a question I get a lot, too. People say, well, you know, I don't care if their government's spying on everyone. They're trying to find bad guys, and I haven't done anything bad. So if it helps the government find the bad guys, why do us good guys have anything to worry about? And there's a really important reason why the James Madisons of the world and why you should be concerned about that idea that only bad guys need to worry about total surveillance of your activities. The fact of the matter is you can't trust the government. You should never trust any government to have that sort of power. In the historical record, and not just ancient history, but recent history, demonstrates that over and over again. When the government has surveillance power and it's unaccountable, it invariably uses that against people at the bottom of the pecking order who are organizing politically. From World War I with the socialists, the labor movement, the anti-war movement of World War I, my God, we had U.S. senators thrown out of the Senate. We had, you know, mayors thrown out of mayordom. We had people locked up like Gene Debs for just nonviolently opposing the war. This power is invariably abused. In the 1960s with the counterintelligence program, they went after peaceful anti-war protesters, civil rights activists. You know, it's funny, they don't go after the bankers. You know, the bankers run the economy off the off a cliff in 2007. You don't find, gee, the government's been surveilling Goldman Sachs' board meetings to find out how they destroy the economy. They never go after those guys. They go after Occupy Wall Street. That's the problem. This arbitrary, unaccountable power invariably is used on behalf of the most powerful elements of society. That's the great danger. And so I guess if you pose no threat, if you just are at all whatsoever politically, you have nothing to worry about. But people who want to exercise their constitutional rights have a lot to worry about when you have this sort of unaccountable power. Another point that Heidi raised that I think is worth emphasizing again is that the national security state, the military in our country, they don't operate in a vacuum. They don't operate in isolation. In fact, they're joined at the hip with corporate America. This is an enormous part of our political economy. It's difficult to imagine our political economy without militarism. George W. Bush hasn't said many things that I've quoted favorably in his career as president or governor before that. But one thing he said, he went to Argentina in 2001 or two during the recession in Argentina, and the Argentine president was doing all sorts of radical things then with the economy that George W. Bush didn't approve of. And what George W. Bush said to him, look, what we do in America when we want to ramp up our economy, we just spend more money on the military. That's sort of the way we get growth in our economy. And he spoke a truth there, which is the sort of reliance our capitalist economy has upon militarism for staying the nose above water with growth. That's a dangerous relationship. And what we see is the largest companies in our economy have very close relations with the military, far too close. They both depend on each other. And this is especially troubling when we look at the internet. Right now, we see companies like Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, AT&T, Verizon, right on down the list. These companies are all vacuum cleaners of information. You know, there's the great line about the internet. If you get something for free on the internet, you're not the customer, you're the product. And you're the product for these companies. And even the ones you're paying money, like Apple or AT&T or Verizon, they treat it the same way. Everything you do there is their property to use to exploit. And what the record shows, and I documented in detail in Digital Disconnect, these companies have a very close relationship with the National Security Agency, with all the police and security forces and military. It's at a number of levels. It's a very rich and rewarding relationship for these companies. They work very closely together, sharing information. It is a disaster, any way you slice it, for a free society. And let me then turn to a question that Bob Jensen raised, really the existential question about, you know, what sort of democracy do we have in that context? What does this mean for our society that our economy is dominated at this level by companies that work closely with an unaccountable surveillance police state apparatus? And here I'm going to turn, interestingly enough, to an economist named Milton Friedman, a conservative economist who taught about 10 miles south of here at the University of Chicago. And Friedman had a very elegant defense, I think, of why capitalism is the best possible society for free society, for liberty. And Friedman's argument in a book called Capitalism and Freedom, which came out just about 50 years ago, was that only in capitalism is control over the economy separate from control over the government. Under feudalism, the king was the richest guy. He ran the economy, he ran the government. Under communism, the Communist Party owns all the economy and they run the politics. So Friedman said, if you have the same people who run the government who run the economy, if they don't like you, they can make it so you can't survive economically. They can make it so you have no existence in the society. Under capitalism, because economic power and political power are separate, there's room for freedom to prosper. Economic power and political power are separate. There's room for freedom to prosper, and you can have a free society. Well, let's check out Friedman's hypothesis with the evidence we have now. What we see is that instead of having a competitive market that's over here, and a government's over here, and they're sort of two different worlds. Instead, we have a non-competitive market dominated by a handful of companies that economists would call monopolies in the olden days. They have so much market power that have total control over what the government does. They're joined at the hip. That sort of breathing space for freedom has disappeared. It doesn't exist anymore. We have what actually comes far closer, and here I say this not to be pejorative, to the textbook definition of fascism. Large corporations and government working very closely together to advance corporate interests, with the government focusing on surveillance, propaganda, and militarism. That's actually the textbook definition of fascism. And I'm not saying that's where we are, nor was Bob, but I think we have to address the facts when we see the evidence as it lays out as it does. And it does get to the other point that Bob alluded to, which is all the new research that's come out in the last few years by the leading political scientists in America that's been published, and I've been monitoring this for the work I did with John, shows that the research shows that the vast majority of Americans have zero influence over government policy whatsoever. In the sense of democracy being the rule of the people, we do not have a democracy. That's not even a debatable question. If you're going by the classical definition. In fact, the research even shows that representatives in Congress, when they work on policies, are more likely than not to take the opposite position from the poorest third of the people in their district. They will never take that position. They always serve the interests of the very wealthy. The debates that are relevant are between wealthy interests. Those are the political debates of our times. And those interests are the ones who set the terms of the debate. In other words, we've got a serious problem, if it isn't clear. Bob, is that depressing enough so far? Good. Now, this is another way to think about the issue of civil liberties it's not normally talked about. Most people look at the issue of surveillance and the loss of our liberties or the right to civil liberties as a matter of you need these liberties in order to have democracy. If you don't have the right to free speech, you don't have freedom of the press, freedom to worship, freedom to assemble like this, then you can't have a democracy. You can still have elections, but they're really going to be bogus, right? But it also works the other way around, and this is where we are. If you don't have a credible democracy, it's very hard for those liberties to survive. If you don't actually have people governing their own countries in a really tangible, meaningful sense, then the liberties that can survive are usually going to be the ones that are unthreatening to people in power or trivial ones. You have the right to have a tattoo on your butt. No one cares about that. But if you're going to criticize people in power over something fundamental like the economy or like militarism, then you're sort of a troublemaker. Got to keep an eye on you. And that happens gradually when democracy loses its substance and becomes a formal shell game. And that's really the moment we're in now. And that's why the two are so tied together. Having civil liberties, having freedoms, having those great constitutional rights really can't survive unless you have a credible democracy they're part of. They can't have one without the other. Either way, it's a two-way street. The framers were well aware of this. Madison and Jefferson in particular, they repeatedly discussed this. They were concerned about militarism, obviously, but they also said there's got to be a solution. What can we do to make sure that we don't go the route of Athens or Rome, that we don't become a militarist society with inequality, secrecy, and propaganda dominating? What is the solution? Well, the Fourth Estate, freedom of the press, having a credible independent news media that gives the information to the great mass of the population to prevent the state from veering off in anti-democratic forms. That was it. I mean, if you read them, that's exactly what they talked about, why we had to have a press system. And it's why the federal government in the first 100 years of American history had enormous subsidies to spawn a huge print media that never would have existed without those postal and printing subsidies, because they knew otherwise, left just to the market, a term no one used then, left just to the market, you'd only have news media for rich people. And you couldn't have a democracy if you just had news media that supported rich people. You had to have a news media that served everyone. So they put in these postal subsidies. They put in these printing subsidies to spawn that. And the first function of this press system had to be to monitor the government in terms of militarism to see that it didn't go off and do about a half-baked wars and become unaccountable. Because Jefferson and Madison knew that this country was, you know, about to take over a continent. They were wise enough to know it would not be a long time till this country was the most powerful country in the world, if not in the world, certainly one of the two or three most powerful. They were sitting in this gold mine continent. They knew that. And they knew that no matter how well-intended elected leaders were, when you get power of something that rich and that vibrant, there's the imperial temptation. And it needs to be closely monitored by a free people to prevent the abuses of militarism and colonialism from taking over in this country. And that was the role of the press. The solution was a free press. And in fact, one of Madison's last lines, shortly before he died, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so I'm paraphrasing, it's not exact, but he said, a society without information, quality information, or access to it by the population cannot be a democracy or republic. It's a prelude to a tragedy or a farce or perhaps both. And that bookends his earlier comments about militarism and survival of freedom. You've got to have that information system. And here, in this case of the surveillance scandal, of the NSA crisis, the failure of the press system is of epic, scandalous proportions. This was unquestionably the lowest hanging fruit story in America the last 10 years. I mean, it was hanging so low it came out in China. You had all these revelations about this going on. When I was doing Digital Disconnect, I was actually just reading the business press and newspapers, and everything that is now considered a revelation was being talked about openly. This, yeah, we know everything about everyone. We're keeping all this. Sure, we turn it over to the cops whenever they ask. We don't care. We're making money. They just said all this stuff. It was the lowest hanging fruit ever. But where were the stories in the Washington Post, in the New York Times? Where were the stories on NPR? Where were the stories on CNN or MSNBC? With a couple of wonderful exceptions, like a series Dana Priest did in the Washington Post in 2010, they were nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. This story was verboten. It was covered the same way the story would have been covered in the Soviet Union in 1955. It was just simply covered like it wasn't a story. You saw the low-hanging fruit, but that's just not something you talk about. Now, why is that? Why is the coverage so dreadfully bad? Part of it was due to the nature of the way professional journalism has devolved in the United States in the last 50 years, so that it basically accurately reports debates between people in power. So it accurately reflects the debates the heads of the Democratic and Republican Party are having. The problem with that wonderful theory of journalism is that if both of them agree on something, like having a secretive spying state and they aren't debating it, there's nothing for journalists to cover. And if a journalist raises the issue, they're considered ideological and unprofessional for talking about something people in power aren't talking about or debating. And that is a wonderful disciplinary effect in keeping journalists in line, not to want to be seen as ideological, unprofessional by covering a story people in power don't consider a legitimate issue. And the second factor, of course, which is unavoidable, that underscores that, is the institutional force, the corporate power that's involved there. That the institutions that dominate and own our news media ultimately are people who are very comfortable with the status quo in America, including the military-industrial complex, and they don't send out the vibes that they really want to challenge this. So ironically, or tragically, but certainly revealingly, it took a nonprofit newspaper from Britain, The Guardian, which is run by family trusts, so they aren't out to satisfy shareholders, they're not owned by billionaires. In Britain, another country that doesn't rely, get its cues from the American upper class on what a legitimate story is, to break this low-hanging fruit story. That says everything one needs to know.
And that, from the recent Democracy in Crisis conference convened in Chicago by Peace Action, Robert McChesney, and also speaking at that event, John Nichols and Bob Jensen, and of course Heidi Bogosian, New York's own head of the National Lawyers Guild. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, Pacifica Radio Network, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM, and streaming at stream.wbai.org. And you have been fine audience tonight, and a significant one at this time of day, and we really appreciate that. And even more, your comments, thoughts, suggestions, queries, leaks, with an email to rknight, that's R-K-N-I-G-H-T, rknight at wbai.org. And we'll be back next week, Wednesday, midnight, and thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf coming up next with Jim Freund.
The Nation magazine as its Washington correspondent. He's the associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison.
Keep resisting.
There are few honors greater than to be on a panel with someone associated with the National Lawyers Guild. Because the National Lawyers Guild understands something fundamental about our rights and our freedoms.
Galaxy 3, Facebook and your search history, Gmail, voicemail, I gotta have it, it's got an on-off switch, baby, I'll
I'm making a list, I'll checking it twice. It doesn't matter the message or even kind of device. Every pic your daughter sends, we've got it ingrained. Why do you think Anthony Weiner wants back in the game? Surveilling reporters, don't ever forget it. I got so many AP docs, you think I'm getting college credit? Yeah, we're saving your searches, that's just a reality. Yes, we can, ain't just a slogan, it's our view on legality.
Nokia, iPhone, Galaxy 3, Facebook and your search history. Gmail, voicemail, I gotta have it. It's got an on-off switch, baby.
I'll tell you this, sir, I greatly abhor your violating of the Constitution upon which you swore, and a full investigation is what's needed and more. You ever Googled Justin Bieber pics? I yield back the floor. I don't see the big deal. Why are we having a cow? I mean, look at all the terrorists that we can focus on now. And it's not like we're planting devices in homes. By the way, did everybody get their free Obama phone?
Come on.
With front-facing cameras, our intel has grown. Look at the video we've collected from this year alone. This is outrageous. We should be able to use the bathroom freely. Hello? Hi. How'd you get this number, really? Nothing is private anyway. We're posting on walls, so what's the big deal if the government is saving your calls? I mean, we share our info with companies. This debate should be chilled.
Everybody come quick! A straw man has been killed!
So the next time you're up late and you're surfing your phone, let me reassure you, baby, that you're never alone. And if you don't think that the spying stuff is really ideal, text yourself about it. Let us know how you feel.
Nokia, iPhone, Galaxy 3, Facebook, and your search history. Gmail, voicemail, I gotta have it. It's got an on-off switch, baby. I'll tap it.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, enchantment, fantasy, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview conducted yesterday afternoon, that's Tuesday afternoon, with the great Kim Stanley Robinson. Stay tuned. Thank you. once again, good morning. Okay, as always, technical difficulties starting out, having to do this time, I won't even get into it. It's called Copyright Confessor, and it's a whole long, sordid story of things that we need to keep up with in order to, keep us alive with different grants. And the way things are going, every single penny counts. Okay, so we have an interview for you this morning. It is a great one. The sound quality is another question. I am still experimenting with creating sound at home using Skype. And actually, at this point, I have everything set at my end. But I have not yet figured out how to count on some other people. And they're having Skype set up. And we had Skype set up perfectly, Stan Robinson and I, but he didn't have a good microphone. So you will forgive some of the sound quality, and there's also some scrabbling noise at a certain point. And in my end, at one point there's a car and a kid, and on his end, there's a cat. Well, it's all part of fascinating talk. And Stan Robinson is one of the great writers. I'm not even going to tell you that much about him because over the course of this interview, which runs about an hour, 20 minutes, so we better get cracking on it, we pretty much cover much of his career. But first, this coming Tuesday, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, October 1st. Now, of course, we hope to see you at the Atlantic Antic on September 29th. But 2 days later, on Tuesday, October 1st, at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is at 138 Sullivan Street, between Houston and Prince, I will be holding the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And our readers are Kate Locke, who I've not yet met, but whose work I've been following, and she's really something. Terrence Taylor, who regular listeners to WBAI have heard any number of times. And our host will be Margot Adler. Yes, she who created Hour of the Wolf, and also she who has read, at this point, upwards of, I think we're up to about 290 vampire novels. And no, it's not just a fetish or an obsession. It is a study. Margot has a new book out about this called Out for Blood. It's what they call an Amazon single, but there's going to be a fix-up version, a larger version with all these notes she's taken on every one of those books coming out in about January. And assuming WBAI is still around in January, well, she'll be here to tell you about it. So, doors open at 6:30. The event begins at 7. Show up at 6:30 to be sure to get a good seat, and also because that's a good time to rub elbows, and we serve free cider and cheese and stuff like that. Admission is free. We do hustle for donations because I put a lot of money into making that event happen, and because we buy all of our participants dinner and drinks, to which, by the way, you are invited to come along. So that's our Vampiric Lore special, our October special at the New York Review of Science Fiction. Again, 138 Sullivan Street. For more information, visit ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, like the name of the show, Hour of the Wolf, or on Facebook. Look for NYRSF, NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or just type in those words, or just type in my name, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you will get all the information that you need. Okay, and then some. So, that should cover it. As I say, this is a long interview with a favorite writer. This is actually, his name is Kim Stanley Robinson, but this is his third time on the show. But you know what? He and I will go into that. I believe there is a moment in the middle of the interview where I probably should have made an edit, but failed to. It was just a question of, you know, some noise that was going out there that I should have cut out. Don't let it bother you. So we're going to start right now. And know also that Stan and I have arranged for another program in mid-November. And that will be live with phone calls. So look forward to that. So set your Wayback Machine to Tuesday afternoon for New York time and 1 p.m. where Stan was. And here we are.
This is Jim Freund. I'm speaking with Kim Stanley Robinson on the afternoon of the 24th, 3 hours difference because you're in California and I'm here in New York. And this is, I think, you probably don't remember, this is actually our third interview. One time being a very long time ago. I can't even begin. I'm not even sure of the decade. I just know it was in New York. It was at a Nebula event, and Dave Hartwell introduced us at a party, and we went off for about 10 minutes.
I remember that. I think that was 1991.
That could be. Mm-hmm. And then after that, when you were guest of honor at Capclave, we ran into each other two nights, actually, with a whole bunch of the Capclave people, the night before the convention was going to begin. And there was a great Mets versus St. Louis Cardinals game that a whole bunch of us watched together. With a great...
If I was the guest at Capclave, that might have been 2006.
Wow, that long ago. Okay. Yeah, well, we can always figure that out by whenever the Mets were playing the Cardinals in the playoffs. And then you and I actually recorded an interview with people sitting around. It was actually a program item. And it was a lot of fun. And I think that the first book in which trilogy was it had just come out. Science in the Capital.
Yes.
Yes.
And I was at a Disclave, not as a guest of honor, as the first book had come out in 2004. So